Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
Beautiful question.
That's a great question.
Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Karen Russell, author of The Antidote, a gripping feat of magical realism set during the Dust Bowl about five characters whose fates become entangled after a storm ravages their small Nebraska town. Karen, we'll get into those characters, but first, thank you so much for joining me to talk about The Antidote. Welcome to The Right Question.
Hey, Lauren, thank you for having me.
This novel centers the fictional town of Uz, Nebraska. Tell me about this town and why it became the setting for what is really, ultimately, a braided, character-driven story.
You know, this book has been around for so very long. I mean, I got the idea when I was a much younger writer, finishing my first novel, and I can't remember if Uz existed then. I knew I was going to write a story set during the Great Depression and during the Dust Bowl drought. And then I think that at a certain point, I had this idea for a farmer who would be almost living the Book of Job in reverse. All of his neighbors' crops, you know, there'd be terrible destruction. And then just on his little plot of land, wheat is growing. There are blue skies, uncannily blue, because, you know, there are these apocalyptic dust storms that seem to be swerving and missing him repeatedly. So that, I think then I learned that the Book of Job is set in the land of Uz, and that sort of is there are allusions to that book throughout this one. But I knew, you know, Western Nebraska. I had written a couple short stories when I was attempting and failing to write this novel. One of them was called Proving Up, and it was set in Nebraska. I went out there and did a research trip, and you know, I grew up in a very different part of the country, a very different ecosystem. So it was good for me to actually like walk around and talk to people. And I think that's how I wound up in Nebraska. It's on set on Pawnee homeland. So it's a fictional town, but not far from the place where I set this short story, which is really a horror story about the Homestead Act.
You mentioned that this is a fictional story with historical foundations. We can definitely get into that. I want to go back, though, to what you said about this book being in existence for a really long time. You've said in other interviews that this is a book you've spent about a third of your life writing. What finally allowed your mind to settle enough, or to soar in this case, maybe? What finally allowed you to tell this story now?
Yeah, I hope it's both, right? It is kind of funny. I think it's such a sort of dusty terrestrial story. And then sometimes I hope there's kind of a bird's eye view of things or a more panoramic wide angle look onto this place. You know, I also feel it's I sort of wasn't trying and failing to write it continuously. I wrote these short story collections, but a lot of those stories, I think in funny ways that were kind of rehearsals or they had the same, they orbited some of the same questions. And I remember trying it from the third person point of view, and it just felt sort of like stiff and dead, just very stilted. When I was, I had two young kids, I had, a newborn and a three-year-old, and it was the pandemic, so everybody was masked. And here in Portland, there were these terrible wildfires. The air was toxic to breathe, so we had sort of like a double pandemic experience. It lasted for 2 weeks. You really couldn't go outside. And I remember like being in the baby's nursery and like smelling this awful, you know, understanding that the danger was, you know, the bill was really coming due for this climate emergency in such a visceral way. That was new to me. I didn't grow up with wildfires. I think a lot of the extreme weather we're experiencing now is becoming frighteningly ordinary to many people. My friend said it's the storm of the century of the week, you know, watching these recent wildfires in LA. I just kept thinking about, that really many more and more of us are kind of experiencing the effects of our climate crisis. Something about that, having these little kids, feeling it in my body in that way. I think it really, after that, it somehow became possible to write from this woman's point of view from the first person. which I hadn't tried before. So it's spooky and mysterious. I'm not really sure why I couldn't and I couldn't. And then it sort of returned. There was a long stretch where I was like, I'm just not a novelist. I write short stories. And I had kind of made my peace with that. But I'm glad now that, you know, that this book haunted me. For I sort of have a different vantage, you know, the vantage of midlife, which feels very different than when I was like a young woman in my, you know, in my 20s. So it might have had something to do with that, too.
And the vantage point of motherhood, it sounds like this would probably be an entirely different book had you not had children in the middle of writing it.
I do think that. I do sincerely think that, like, they make everything feel more acute. And they make, you know, I think part of it too, I had this real wish. I was writing some pretty dark stuff at that time. Not that this book
it's dark. It's dark. Yeah. Yeah.
But I really found myself wanting some new inputs for my own imagination, like wanting to try to make some visions of a future world that isn't the apocalypse we can all get to. Many of us can. Instantaneously just extrapolating from the present. It doesn't really take that much energy, I think, for many of the smartest people I know to model like a hell world or a fortress world or a world where, you know, the wealth gap is even wider than it is today. A world of like, you know, cemetery skies and seas. It's too easy to do that, right? Mm. It's an indictment, I think, of like how we are living today. And if you can get to a dystopia easier than sort of a functioning world, it's interesting to think, well, what are the barriers to imagining like a caring and caretaking society? What makes it hard for that to feel as vivid and plausible as like Mad Max, you know? And so that, I think I was thinking about that with my children too, like trying to imagine on a longer timeline, but also feeling like, wow, the stakes are, they feel different to me than they did, you know, when I was first dreaming this up, you know, in like 2011.
Yeah, maybe that's the answer to my next question, this idea of stakes. We're talking about, you just said, the Homestead Act. We're talking about an era defined by the Dust Bowl. And one of the events of this novel is Black Sunday. It's a Dust Bowl event that blackened the sky over the Great Plains with this really, really dry, dry farmland topsoil. And soil ecology is sort of imperative to our understanding in hindsight of what happened during the Dust Bowl, that era, and on this landscape. You spoke also about sparking the imagination. Is there something about soil and what we now know about it, what we know about topsoil and regenerative farming and indigenous practices even, that sparked your imagination, both as a writer and as a human with, as you were saying, these living stakes on our planet?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Lauren. That's a really brilliant, much more economical than I know how to be about the what feels so important about soil. And soil, again, it's not sexy to many people. It really wasn't to me for a while. But I grew up in near the Everglades in urban South Florida. So a really short, about equidistant from like strip malls and also this like primordial ecosystem. And part of the research project for my earlier book was learning about this kind of campaign of, you know, the Dredge and Fill campaign and like how I came to be there, right? It's a tourist economy. Fantasy is like the big industry in Florida. And then part of the paradox is people really love this place and they're aware, right, that the way that we're living there is killing this place. I mean, the Everglades used to be this tremendous, it was a watershed and like water slowly flowed from Lake Okeechobee all the way down to South Florida. And it was this exquisitely attuned, you know, it had its own kind of hydrological patterns. And then there was this campaign of diking and draining the swamp. And it's about a third of its original size. And the Army Corps of Engineer sort of made an Audubon of water. And over the last 30 years, there have been these restoration efforts to try to get the Kissimmee River to restore the original flow. And since they've done that, like 99% of the birds and flora and fauna have come back. But it wasn't like, you know, it was sort of changing something that just, you know, restoring the logic that already existed. I found myself thinking about that a lot with the story of the Dust Bowl. I mean, one thing that I didn't learn when I was a younger person, I think they really laid the stress in my school on the, you know, the economic collapse, right, of the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. We lost a lot of fertility that was banked in the soil. Mm-hmm. And that came to feel even more horrifying to me, you know, in the because that isn't something you can get back. And you just can't make more of it, right? I mean, it's not.
Yeah.
It's sort of, I know, you know, also these farmers, like there was this terrible irony where it's dry land farming during this period, but they're sitting on the Oglala Aquifer, but now we've almost drained all of this paleo water. So I think that idea of like not really respecting nature's laws and limits, you know, not really knowing how to live within them, that feels like the story of both novels I've written to me in some ways. And then on the flip side of that coin, maybe what feels hopeful is like, oh, but we do, the solution is like here with us. And it might not be joining Elon Musk's space fleet, you know? It might be here on Earth kind of trying to design our lives and our policies around these processes that took billions of years to evolve and that give us everything. I mean, I think that like topsoil, I didn't learn that in school, and I would reverence it in a different way if I knew like, oh my God, like several inches of fertile soil give us everything here. Like the air we breathe, all of our food, and that you just can't, you actually like can't strip the products of photosynthesis and export them. Like you have to leave them in the ground.
You're listening to A Conversation with Karen Russell. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Chapter One Bookstore in Hamilton, Montana, a literary and community resource for the Bitterroot Valley, providing space to explore, discover, and share passions since 1974. More information can be found at chapteronebookstore.com. I think I want to pivot from talking about the landscape, which is, you know, obviously such an integral part of this book, but I want to pivot to characters. I kind of led this conversation with this idea that this is a character-driven story. You mentioned that you've written this book in the first-person perspective, from the perspective of the eponymous character, the antidote. I know readers of your past work will want to kind of get into the magic of this novel, so let's do it. Who am I to deprive them of this joy? Talk about this prairie witch, Karen, the antidote, and about the plural, the prairie witches, which in this book you've collectively called the vaults. Tell me about these characters.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I've always loved witches. Who doesn't? I think what's kind of interesting about releasing this book when Wicked is having such a moment is I'm encouraged to see how many of us truly love witches.
And I am so glad you mentioned Wicked. I'm so curious about the thoughts you had of writing into this canon or this universe of The Wizard of Oz, even in hindsight, because, you know, we've got Uz and not Oz, though I know you said this is also in reference to the Book of Job. We've
right.
got Nebraska and not Kansas, mm-hmm. but we've also got witches and memory and even a scarecrow with growing sentience. I mean, the parallels are right there. Were they intentional? Did you mean to be writing into this universe, or were they not intentional at all?
Yeah, I mean, the parallels are absolutely there. I think obviously that made a tremendous impression on me as a young person. This book also starts with an apocalyptic dust storm, you know, and like there's a cyclone that spins Dorothy away. There's sort of this like ragtag group of friends that are kind of on a quest together in that novel. And this one, there are a bunch of, very people who are sort of very immersed in their own kind of concerns that become united in the same mystery. And it's sort of they all become sort of, some of them more ambivalently than others or more grudgingly than others, they end up using their gifts in the service of justice, which I, you know, surprised me drafting it. I didn't know that going in. I think that the literary, the Book of Job, I was maybe more consciously courting as an influence. And I think I also feel like a little, you know, L. Frank Baum, that is an incredible work. He was a complex figure, and he actually had some heinous views, racist and dehumanizing views about Native Americans. So especially in relation to this book, I feel like, you know, those are certainly so much of this book is written to sort of bring those views to light. But I do, and I think I love what I love in Wicked is the way that you have these female protagonists who are so powerful, and how threatening and destabilizing actually that is to like the status quo, right? How the wizard really wants to kind of co-opt and use that power. I think that this book, you know, someone was asking me about it. I was like, well, my witches don't have like the vocal range of Elphaba. And, you know, actually the antidote, you know, I'm worried a little bit this will get shelved as like self-help or something. And I should just tell your listeners now, like, this is a woman who calls herself the antidote, and she is offering as kind of a cure-all for everything from gas pains to nightmares to regret to shame to, you know, backache, mm-hmm. all the ways that a history can manifest as pain in a body. She says, I'll wipe that all out for you. Just tell me the unbearable thing, or tell me the thing that's so beautiful. It's disrupting linear time, and you can just pour your memories into me and I'll hold them here for you, you know, like water in a barrel, you know, like vinegar in a jar, and you can come back and just get them anytime. And it's almost like if you've ever had like a tooth pulled out, you know, the second that it's extracted, sometimes instantly this agony gets snuffed. I was sort of imagining it that way. But people don't remember, you know, kind of what, you know, if you smile, you can see exactly where that tooth used to be. I mean, this woman's customers have no idea what they've just told her. And a lot of them sort of orphan their memories inside her. They don't care to come back and retrieve them. So that is my witch lady. She's sort of a traumatized woman who's selling oblivion as a cure-all, and it does not go well.
Talk about the impetus for that idea. Memory is both the very real thing and the very magical thing around which this book is sort of centered, or, you know, this idea toward which this book is leaning, this idea of historical memory. Where did that idea come from, and when did it become the aboutness of this story?
Yeah, I mean, and sort of, I think always I'm the last to know, or I realize this only after like 8 iterative drafts, you know, that I'll sort of wake up to what something seems to want to be about. Hmm. In this case, I think I really did know, because I had this idea that there would be this sort of secret network of women storing memories for people. And also because of my experience as a child and adolescent in Florida, and sort of only after I had exited that state, really doing some research and like thinking about the blinders that I had been wearing. So, I mean, part of it was researching my first novel and sort of thinking about this family and sort of these kids who are kind of stranded in like a limbo, like that is very much like a swamp, where they know that one story is a lie, but they don't really know what is true. They don't have like a functioning map of reality. I think right now also in my home state, you know, you can see in this contest for the future, it's playing out in schools and in libraries and in how history is taught. Mm-hmm. That was true then as well. And I think I started looking at archives from this period and thinking about how much of my own understanding was curated, by what exists and what substitutes for collective memory. If you don't live through this time personally, maybe you see Dorothea Lange's Migrant Mother, or you see these amazing photographs. There's a shadow archive of kind of hole-punched images. And that started to like stand in for me, just a way to sort of think and feel through what's occluded from view. And some of it is like, right, there are sometimes really strategic attacks or distortions of the history we're taught. Sometimes I think in our own families, certain things don't get passed down. Mm-hmm. Shame is very silencing, and that can apply to harms done or harms endured. And that doesn't get shared, and it can feel quite private, I think, an individual. And so this book was a way for me to think through, well, oh my goodness, but in aggregate, how does there become this kind of mass denial or mass forgetting? I was just speaking to somebody in Wichita, and we were talking about how, you know, you can grow up in a place with a lot of native names.
Yeah.
And not understand, right? They're just sort of really, really, really disconnected from any sense of the original people who are still here. You know, it's not remote history. I mean, I think one thing that was striking to me about this book and moving was talking to a lot of people. Pawnee historian James Ridingen was a tremendous help to me. Brock Anderson, Lakota, Nebraska historian, other folks who I just called, Sherry Beam, you know, people who are descendants of homesteaders in Nebraska. And they really shared personal memories that reminded me, like, these times were very much alive. you know? Mm. This isn't like the distant past, and it's still shaping our living today.
Yeah, and if we're thinking about history, history is not the past. History is the past, the present, the future.
Yeah.
It's not really a no longer, but it's, you know, it's happening now.
Right.
You mentioned these photographs, Karen. I want to go back to these photographs. One of the characters in the novel is a New Deal photographer. It's this Black woman named Cleo, one of my favorite characters. She's tasked with taking photos of the Great Plains during this time of these people who are sort of left reckoning with the collapse. This character, her camera, her photographs, these are sort of additional vessels for what I've been calling this Karen Russell magic. But her subplot, her character, they might be seen as, you were talking about hope earlier, they might be seen as representing something a lot more optimistic than many of the histories that are brought to light in this story.
Right.
Talk about the importance of hope, or if not hope, because honestly, that's something that's so hard to hold on to right now.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
talk about the importance of something like repair, or as you write in the book's coda, mm-hmm. of restoration. Talk about those ideas in a story like this one, or in a story like ours, our collective story.
It's our collective story, right? Where nobody is untouched by this history, as you mentioned, Lauren. I mean, it really is shaping our present. And I think, you know, it is a moment where I think there's a lot of warranted fear and dismay about what is happening in our country. I had in this book these sort of two, I think I sort of write like a child in this way, you know, like it's helpful for me to think through some of these huge abstract things to really make them eye level embodied. And then some of the fantastical conceits, I hope, right, illuminate something that's sort of hard or slippery. So there's this, these witches take deposits. They all have their own conduits, they call them. The antidote uses an ear horn. It looks kind of like a gramophone horn, like one of these antique hearing aids. And things funnel in and out of this, you know, in and out of her customers' bodies into her body, or you know, the reverse. Cleo Alfrey is based on some of the New Deal photographers that I think will be familiar. You know, Dorothea Lange, I mentioned, amazing Gordon Parks, whose memoirs really helped me kind of to understand the experience of working for the project or being a photographer. He's a African-American man who's a photographer for the historical section and later called the Resettlement Administration, Farm Securities Administration. Mm-hmm. And that was tasked with sort of introducing America to Americans. And there was always this tension between kind of propaganda, you know, but documenting reality and sort of making propaganda for the New Deal programs, like showing their the need for them and the success of them. I found myself thinking about that quite a bit. And one thing that I really think is true, to your point about hope feeling hard to hold on to, I think that envisioning work is so important. Mm. And I really came to a place where I felt, it, in proportion to how hard it feels, how necessary it is, I think people, you know, the other vision, the vision of sort of like a hell world or a dystopia, it's so easy for us to get there. It takes a lot more effort to say, like, what, as we were saying, like, what would have to change to make this functioning, caring, and caretaking place possible? Mm-hmm. I talked to a neuroscientist who works on the motor system. And he said, well, movement is always a manifestation of optimism. You move because you think there's a better state that you're going to reach. And I was thinking, you know, about the difference between like running from certain scenarios or trying to shore up the little you have, like not wanting to lose more, mm-hmm. How different that feels energetically than saying like, here is the vision I hold collectively with others. This is the kind of world I'd like to live in where housing is a human right. Healthcare is a human right. There's clean air and water. People have spacious time to dream in. People get to work in professions that fulfill them, but that are also lifeward. They're not welded to these systems that we know are destroying everything, right? Farmers get to farm and they're not driven by debt and fear. And you know, there are ways where they can respect the limits of what the land can support. I mean, that shouldn't sound so pie in the sky, right? Like, right. I feel like, so I talked to a lot of people doing restoration work in different ways. And what was moving to me was feeling like, oh, it's all in service of this this world of healing. So one of the more moving things that happened to me was getting to go to Nebraska and meet Nebraskan farmers who are working with the Pawnee Seed Preservation Project to grow Pawnee corn, you know, for the first time in like 150 plus years on Pawnee lands again.
Wow.
And, but there's also these new friendships that are forming.
Yeah.
There's a gentleman called Art Tandera, and he befriended people in the Ponca Nation, and they stood together against Keystone. And stood, you know, they were water protectors yeah. together, and he has deeded some of his land back to the Ponca Nation. So,
wow.
So there are like stories. If you go, there's a podcast I love, Reconciliation Rising. Mm. If people need new inputs, like if they need, there's also, my friend Rebecca Claren wrote an amazing book, The Cost of Free Land.
Mm.
And, you know, it's a phenomenal work of kind of memoir and journalism. Her Jewish ancestors homesteaded Lakota land, and now she started a fund to return the value of that land to the nation. So there are a lot of, I mean, it's, you know, I was just sort of like, wow, what happens when you don't wait for the federal government to kind of take the lead on some of these questions of how do we heal? How do we repair?
Yeah.
And it was useful to me to like actively seek out. I needed that because my imagination felt pretty crushed.
Mm. You mentioned your budding or growing relationship with James Riding In. And you end your novel with a lost land acknowledgement written by James.
Yeah.
Tell me about this decision to place this acknowledgement at the back of your book. And tell me about your relationship with James, the relationship you've built with him while writing and researching this novel.
Oh, for sure. I really love James, and I'm so grateful to him. I mean, we joke about this now. I had read some of his work about relations between white settlers and sort of like the aggression experienced by the Pawnee Nation during this period. And I felt that I needed help. You know, I felt that I had come to the end of what I could imagine alone. So I cold called him. I'd watched some of his, he has wonderful presentations too. You guys just Google James Riding and I'm going to, some are on my website now. But I cold called him, and like this was at a time where like I can't imagine anybody would love to see Karen on their, you know, photo ID. I mean, I don't know, man. I was like, we'd laugh about it. I'm like, God, that must have been so scary. Sorry, James. But he was like, yeah, this sounds really important, and let's talk about it. And he really didn't know me. I was a stranger, you know. He spoke to me for hours, and we just kind of kept conversing.
Mm.
I've also become friends with his niece. And I think a lesson for me was just hearing from both of them in different ways, like, it would feel better if we had a relationship. You know what I mean? Like, that's actually something that takes patience and cultivation. And we're not thinking about it in that way, right? Neither of them were. Of the lessons I've learned, I think that was a pretty profound one.
That was Karen Russell, author of The Antidote, out now from Knopf. To listen to this conversation again, to share it with friends, or to learn more about Karen, head to mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.